Hello and welcome to recording number 25 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 21st, 2021. We've just read through the section where Gord and Geller and Chert have made their way to Crockport and then off into the Vesvi Forest. Then the story switched over to Molag, where the hierarchs of the Horn Society were gathering. And we saw the chief of the hierarchs, and what they've summed up from Hades is the King Daemon of Hades, and that is Anthraxis. All right, so it is page 233 and the second paragraph, and I'm going to start right there. "Greetings, Lord of Gloom," said the greatest of the remaining 10 hierarchs, acknowledging Anthraxis by the least of his titles as if in a challenge. The Daemon King made no sign that he had noticed the affront. "And to you all," the thing replied in a voice that seemed to issue from an empty chest and a throat choked with maggots. "I am come at the behest of Nerol to assist you in your war." None of the 10 flinched at the mention of the war, even though they had only today received news that masses of Uz's troops were marching through the northern regions of their realm. Again the greatest spoke. "We serve evil and acknowledge Nerol as overlord. We likewise serve the same ends as thee. But why is it that our one master does not himself come?" The great Oinio Daemon sneered and put out a cloud of fetid breath in answer. "Play not fools, you remaining hierarchs. Isn't the loss of 3 of your number enough to teach you your place?" The spokesman seemed totally unaffected by the implication of the question. "You mean as his servants," he replied in an icy, level tone. "What else?" Anthraxis shot back in a voice that would sicken any normal listener. "Of course, Lord of Glooms, just as you come to us." And the spokesman allowed his voice to trail off, but raised a finger and spoke again. "The 3 who represented Tartarus, Hades, and Gahanna are gone. We have not yet had the trials which will elevate 3 of our own number to these exalted positions and bring 3 lessers to sit with the 10. Until we are 3 and 10 once again, our power is insufficient against that rebel who opposes the unification." "You waste my time," Anthraxis said in a voice that coughed and choked. "No master of Daemonkind, you are wasting your time and ours too. We 10 eared, but not as did the former 3. It is not my place to question the removal of the offenders by the master of us all, but I do state now that unless the society is given aid, we and the unification are in jeopardy. Do not place undue importance on yourselves or your petty realm," the Oina Daemon wheezed angrily. "And why did Lord Nerol send you to us?" the speaker asked mildly. Anthraxis shook his rotting ram-like head in frustration. "I am come to make certain you make no further errors, and to aid you against the might of that fungi, fornicating, toad-spawned whelp of a miserable little demon princeling, Uz." The spokesman nodded with neither pride nor fear in expression, or the voice statement that followed. "Now we understand fully, Lord of Hades, but there is that which must be spoken. What if the Cambion gains the second key?" "Then you will take it from him," said the ghastly, diseased voice of the Oina Daemon, rasp, "and I shall be there to see you do not fail again." Bits of decaying matter fell from Anthraxis, dropping here and there as he went. The Oina Daemon had been standing before the 10 of the hierarchs for an extended period, and a small circle of the putrescent matter had accumulated around his filthy greatcloak. As he was about to turn and leave, he saw the faces of the enthroned ten turn pale, eyes start, hands shake. He followed their staring gaze down the hem of the garment where the litter of rotting stuff oozed and stank. The stuff had become a fairy ring of fungi, tiny zygomes sprouting from the rot. And at that moment, Anthrax's felt fear crawl through his plagued body. Break. All right, so here, at the very last, is like the most important thing. All the Hierarchs notice that Anthrax's is rotting detritus that comes from his body has formed a fairy ring of fungi, showing the power of Zuchtmoy. Is already is able to affect him, and you know, at least if not him himself, then the discharge coming off of him. It's, you know, it's there's a few things that I'm confused at here. Number one, first when Melf saw the host of the Hierarchs coming from across the Vang, there was one Hierarch. And then another had joined, and then a third, who I thought was the leader. But then it seemed to be that Nerl was actually the leading, you know, the leading Hierarch. So I'm not sure what was actually happening there. Now, after Gord said the banishment spell that failed, it wiped out the army of the Hierarchs, all the lower, you know, lesser creatures. But it also seems to have slain the three Hierarchs and done something to perhaps banish Nerl himself, even though there's some conflict in that statement from what the Cat Lord was saying. So, you know, I'm not really clear, even after having just read this and gone through it and looked at it point by point. I'm not entirely sure of what was happening here. It wasn't spelled out exactly, and so I'm unsure of what was happening when the after Gord read the scroll of banishment and was sent off to the Cat Lord's realm. What actually happened to Nerl, the daemon that he was riding? Why there are three Hierarchs gone? When it seemed to me that Nerl, was he inhabiting the body of the one Hierarch? I don't know how that goes or anything. So it seems that the three most important of the Hierarchs have been slain. All right, and Anthraxis, who seems, you know, he's the king of the plane of Hades, does not seem to be quite as powerful. Now, one of the things, too, is that it mentions that these three Hierarchs are representing on Earth Hades, Guiana, and one of the other realms here. And, you know, I'm not sure of exactly what the relationship is. Now, Nerl himself is a Flannish god of death. So it is, you know, it is a little, it's hard to place in this hierarchy with the daemons, because Nerl himself is not a daemon. So, and it seems to be that he is more powerful than Anthraxis. So I'm not quite sure. We don't have things quite spelled out for us as far as the Horn Society goes. So a lot of these things we have to just kind of piece together. There also seems to be some kind of conflict from the greatest of the ten surviving Hierarchs and Anthraxis himself, which kind of surprises me. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 234 in the final paragraph. Obmi and the crazed elf Keek move carefully once they were well beyond Littleburg. They rode sharply west to gain the no man's land between Valuna and Furiundi. Once therein, they veered northward again toward the great forest above. It was dangerous going for them, with patrols to avoid, groups of bandits to dodge or evade, and occasional brushes with feral animals or night-stalking monsters to deal with. Despite all that, Abmi was satisfied with their progress. Keek had told the dwarf about the curious elf, the last probable pursuer they had, but none followed. None knew where he went, and he had the prize. Scarcely a sennight after leaving Littleburg, they came to the seedy little village of Stump. Abmi sought an agent of us there, but none were to be found. In fact, because of Keek, they were virtually treated as untouchable by the folk of the village. The residents of Stump had a reputation for aiding and abetting outlaws and reavers if they were paid. There were places to dispose of stolen goods in the village, brothels and a gambling hall for disposing of excess coin. Elven knights had been to the village just days before. Their men-at-arms, elves-at-arms to be correct, had searched the whole community and discovered property that could be identified as stolen goods. Villagers were hanged on the spot, and a half dozen were carried off for questioning. That, Abmi thought, explained why there was no help for them there. They stayed and debauched themselves a day or two anyway, for the dwarf thought a second visit from the knights improbable. As he had hoped, a scar-faced half-orc and several men appeared in Stump asking for a dwarf. The villagers, thinking that these ruffians had come to kill both Abmi and Keek, cheerfully directed the group to where the dwarf and elf swilled cheap wine and sported. Abmi killed the proprietor of the establishment, as he looked expectantly for an attack upon the pair of customers he would have murdered himself if he dared. Laughing, Keek dragged the best-looking of the women from the place. In a few minutes, they were riding into the edge of the towering forest, and the low folk of the village quickly forgot that they had ever been in Stump. All right, break. Now, I'm not familiar with the exact location of Stump. Chris has put up a little map of Furiundi here. I'm not sure where is Stump on this map.
Stump is to the left of the shield with the two hammers and the green on the bottom.
All right, I see it now, just under the lines of the F of Furiundi. That seems kind of strangely close from what they're saying, because what Gygax had been saying is that they had been riding northwest into an area that was like a no man's land between Valuna and Furiundi.
It is northwest of Littleburg on the road to Chendal eventually.
Yes, but it still seems too much in the heart of Furiundi.
Right.
And I think from what he's saying, it should be much closer to the southern area of the Vesvi, rather than where, you know, there's children. And I believe, is that Fountain Spring up at the top, or is that someplace else?
Yeah, it's Fountain Spring.
That's Fountain Spring. All right, so, yeah, it does seem very odd, especially if Stump is so lawless. And you notice that the elven patrols came in, which would make me think that it should be very much further northwest and up near the High Folk, because I don't think that would be an elven patrol coming out of Furiundi, but instead a patrol from the High Folk, you know, coming out and raiding. It sounds more like Stump should be like the town where Gordon Chert had stopped the Hunter's Town. And this bit of lawless. What was that? Tushum. That's right.
Tushum, yeah.
Yeah. it seems to me Stump should be much further northwest. In fact, if we're looking at things where Littleburg is, I think Fountain Spring is more likely to be where Stump is, and Stump is more likely to be where Fountain Spring is. You know, because Fountain Spring seems to be fairly, you know, frontier, but not quite as much as Stump seems to be, you know, rather lawless and out of the area of Furiundi itself.
Yeah, it makes sense based on the description.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe, you know, there's some confusion about the two. I really think Stump should be up by Fountain Spring. Fountain Spring would be better placed, I think, down by where Stump is. All right. I'm going to continue here. Everybody, you know, in this thing, we get a little, scarcely a senite, it says. Now, a senite, what is the length of a senite? Do you know? I'm not sure if that is.
I think it's a week.
All right.
I'll check
it. So they're doing a week's travel after leaving Littleburg. And now we're looking at 12 miles per hex, and Stump is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8, which would be, you know, roughly about 100 miles or less from Littleburg. Now, if they're using week, all right. So if they're using their, you know, they're riding, they don't have any burdens on them. It's just the two. And the other thing that is noted is that during their travels, they had to avoid bandits. The no man's land between Valuna and Furiundi, toward the great forest above. Dangerous goings. Now, the patrols I can see, but groups of bandits and brushes with monsters. I think that really, it seems to me that this should be, if it took them a week to get there, I'm really saying that Stump and Fountain Spring, if you switch the two, it kind of makes better sense. Although I think Fountain Spring should be even closer to Littleburg. It took about a day's travel, a daylight day's travel to get from Fountain Spring to Littleburg and then over to Broadford, where there was the bridge that they crossed. So I think the map we're seeing right here is a little bit off.
Yeah, I think it would be better somewhere closer to the forest.
Yeah, and it sounds it definitely is not in the no man's land between Valuna and Furiundi if it's right under the F of Furiundi. Mm-hmm. And it's relatively just 100 miles northwest of Littleburg, or a little less than that. So I would say make a note to look into Stump and Fountain Spring. And from the descriptions, I think they're transposed. I just, probably when somebody was writing second edition material or Living Greyhawk material, they really did not look into what was being said in this book and probably came up with their own placement for both locations.
Even Fountain Spring, I think, would be too close to Chendal in the center and the heart of Furiundi.
Yeah, from what it said, now, Fountain Spring's going to be, well, it's just the whole distance thing that when they were riding, Melf and the group, when they were coming back from Fountain Spring, it seemed only to take from the morning to the evening to get back into the Littleburg area. And just by traveling on horseback. So I would put that at about, you know, four hexes maybe a little less, you know, at 10 miles a hex, you know, about 40 miles traveled by horseback. And then with Stump, it's that's one day. And with Abmi and Keek, it's only taking them a week to get from Littleburg to Stump. But again, I'd push that up to Fountain Spring or even further, you know, further northwest, and then into an area where the high folk would be patrolling, you know. So now we see from the map, it shows, you know, it does show a lot of a lot of forest growth here, but with sparseness, you know. And I'm not sure how much that would make sense. Now we see on this map there's a Tushum, all right, down at the end of the near div. I'm not sure. I can't really make out anything. I believe Crockport is to the east, like it's supposed to be. Chendal's a little far south, but I would say Stump, you know, Stump should be either, you know, should be, well, there's Fountain Spring. I think Stump should actually be closer off of, I can't make out what that says, but there is a place off the one river called, what is that, Barrenford? I don't know. It maybe isn't placed well at all, but I think it would be further up than Fountain Spring, probably where those roads seem to intersect. Is that called the Royal Highway?
Yeah, all the way up top, there's a little area between the Vesvi, Furiondi, and Bologna, above the Royal Highway.
Yeah, I would think that. You know, Stump may actually...
Oh, Barrenford.
Barrenford. You see that off the river there?
Yeah, on the Belvedere.
I don't know that Stump... Okay. I think Stump would be maybe a town in that area there, but maybe not on the Royal Highway, unless we later learn... Because Stump seems like an out-of-the-way location. And enough of a place where it has a presence... would normally have a presence of Uzian spies. So that is something to look toward, is where Stump would actually be. And I don't think Fountain Spring either. I think further, much further west, like another 50 or 60 miles west of northwest of Fountain Spring. All right, because it's a week's travel, they say, from Littleburg to Stump, and that should be, you know...
Is that 140 miles, or, like, what is it, 20 miles a day on horse?
Oh, no. Well, unless the terrain was rougher, more than 20 miles a day. 20 miles a day is about what you can march easily. On horseback, you're going to at least, I think, double that to 40 miles a day. Okay. So you would get from Fountain Spring to Littleburg in about 40 miles distance. And then from Stump, it's a week distance, so, you know, you're looking probably 200 miles from Littleburg. Depending on, you know, what kind of problems they had, but this said they didn't have too many problems, just that it was dangerous going for them. All right. I am going to restart. It's page 235 in the final paragraph. The going was slow but steady. The half-orc was the leader, and the three men who served him were skilled woodsmen. After seeing the dwarf's hammer in action, none questioned his assumption of leadership. Keek was even more feared than Abmi because of the elf's absolute unpredictability. There were stations, lone huts, tiny thorps, or hidden places where they found a safe night's rest, food, even fresh mounts. After a few days more, men and a handful of arboreal orcs joined them as reinforcements. The arboreal orcs were new to both Abmi and Keek. The creature seemed to show a strong strain of ape, and this fascinated both dwarf and elf. Eventually, Keek gave the woman to the ape-orcs, and they soon killed her. By then, the band was halfway through the Vesvi, and Uz sent Obmi word that a fitting escort was coming to bring them safely to Doraki. At this same time, almost at the same moment, Morden Kanan himself took the field. With him were his trusted henchmen of old, as well as the Grey Elf fighter and magic user, Melf, and several companies of deadly elves and hard foresters. The Archmage had waited quietly as the second key came ever nearer to him. Now he would strike quickly, take the thing, and return with it to the Citadel. Then let evil rave and threaten. Let the forces of good demand. He would hold the key, and with it would withstand such threats easily. As long as the factions of the maligned fought and quarreled, as long as men established nations and states and fought among themselves, this long would there be need for those who saw the whole as a slowly turning wheel. Neutral, even though generally despising true evilness, the Obsidian Citadel would remain strong and assist the balance. The possession of the second key guaranteed that. Why then, Morden Kanan wondered as he set about his foray, did the Hierophants of the Cable not support him? Jealousy, he supposed. That must be the reason. All right, break. This is page 236 and the end of chapter 21. So, we get a little more. We'll look at this business of that, thinking about Stump again. Now, Stump is the last town or village of any size that Obmi and Keek encounter before they are going into the Vesvi, and then the band ends up halfway, I would assume, westward into the depth of the Vesvi without northward, which would take them much further toward us and his control. So I'm kind of assuming here they're still making, I believe, northwest, because it was mentioned last time that us controls the depth of the forest. So I would assume that that's where they're headed, for the depth, and then maybe fully north to get to the northern part of the Vesvi. We have mention of the arboreal apes, which are like ape orcs. One of the things, we again have more about the evil character of Keek and Obmi. They're just going to be, like pure, unrelenting evil, I think, those guys. Now we have Morden Kanan, and Morden Kanan does a good explanation of why he is not, he's encouraging the forces of evil, like Obmi and Keek, to get nearer and nearer to him so he can swoop down and take the second key. And in this, I think, well, it's here's the thing about that I was trying to say, at least in conversation before, about the neutrality. That neutrality is generally in opposition of the real, absolute evil. But they are mostly interested in their own self-interests. And that does not, you can see where the formation of nations and the wars between good societies, Morden Kanan really looks down upon. He really sees it as a wheel, and so balance is one side up, another side down, but balance is supposed to be the hub of the wheel, that which is not changing while the outer spokes are moving around very fast. And so they have this business with the Obsidian Citadel, and I at first had questioned whether it was another organization, but I'm pretty certain from the context he's talking in now that it's actually just a description of Mordenkainen's fortress rather than any organization. So, you know, I don't know if that changes or is questioned in other editions, but in this book right here, I'm pretty certain that when we're talking of the Obsidian Citadel, we are talking about the actual fortification of Mordenkainen. Just like Tenser has his own powerful citadel on the Nexus points of power, here Mordenkainen has what sounds like a very strong fortification within, I believe, within the mountainous regions at the end of the Vesvi. And here he is waiting. So, again, when we're talking about how Abmi is traveling, if he's coming up against those mountainous areas, he's definitely not moved all that far north, but he has moved out of Furiondi into the reaches of the High Folk and Mordenkainen. All right, now there's finally the mentions of the Hierophants of the Cable, and I believe they're a neutral organization as well, but it seems like Mordenkainen, and perhaps also, I don't know, he is, the major power in the Circle of Eight, but it sounds like the Hierophants of the Cable, or the Cabal, who are another force of neutrality, are not, that these forces are not exactly aligned together.
I think Mordenkainen might be true neutral, and they're neutral evil, so I think they have their own agenda here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that the Druids went to see them at one point to find out information. I believe at the beginning of this book, they mentioned the Hierophants of the Cable. When Curly took the box and that they had gotten from the little relic that they had gotten in Saga of Old City at the end from the Catabaline Demon, that to identify it, he actually went to the Druids, talked to the great Druid and the chief Druid and that, and then they went to the Hierophants of the Cable and our Cabal. So, and we have here, Chris has put up from, I believe, Rogue's Gallery, Mordenkainen was Gygax's player character. He was a neutral magic user, level 16, so he was extraordinarily powerful from the first edition. I believe Tenser was like 14, and Mordenkainen is 16. I believe in the Circle of Eight, Mordenkainen has always been the most powerful. And, it is very, one of the things, this is very good to note, that we do get, you know, the eye view of Mordenkainen right here, and see from his eyes and his viewpoint. So if you're looking, to flesh him out, more than likely as some kind of powerful NPC, you can get a good idea of how he's thinking. And Mordenkainen very much is a leader. And, I think he looks at himself. Imagine he's thinking that the Hierophants of the Cable are jealous of him. So, there's some markings of what Mordenkainen is like right there. And amusing that he's Gygax's character. All right, I am going to restart. It's page 237, the beginning of chapter 22 and the first paragraph. "Never have I heard such music," breathed one. The other sat silently, still hearing the singing, perhaps, and made no reply. "What are your names?" the bard asked quietly. "I'm called Thatcher, or Thatch, as my friend says," the taller of the two lads answered. "And I am Shad, although the folk of the village make it to be Shadow, for I follow my friend Thatch." One who had been silent piped. Feller nodded and smiled. "We're glad to have you at our fire, Thatch and Shad. Why did you follow us here?" "Well, sir," the gangling boy said with a nervous swallow, "Shad and I want to be hunters. When we heard you speak of wild boar, we decided to join you. If you slay the devil pig, you'll be famous hereabouts, Then so will we. The boy called Shadow bounced in eager agreement. He heard where you were going, so we cut through the forest and got ahead of you. When you passed, it was easy to follow. Ord looked at Chert, and the big barbarian shrugged. Geller had somehow brought the boys into their camp with his singing. That was clear. Ord wanted to know if the bard knew when he began the melody that the boys, or somebody, was near. He had heard nothing, and it seemed that Chert had likewise been unaware of the presence of the two. The young thief remained silent, though, allowing Geller to do all the talking. The one-eyed man was certainly getting answers. Why did you come so close? We couldn't make our own fire, so we had to be near yours for protection. There's things in the night, you know, which would gladly have us for their dinner, Thatch responded. I'm sorry we disturbed you by coming into the circle, but when you sang and played, we just had to. No matter, boys, we're pleased you join us, aren't we? And as he spoke, the latter, he glanced meaningfully at his comrades. Chert rumbled a greeting, and Gord nodded and smiled. There, Geller said, we're all friends here. Tell me, what did you hear us talking about? Oh, Thatch said, and then he looked toward his friend for help. Shad looked away, shifting nervously. Geller looked at the bigger youth and prompted him to go on by saying, it's fine to say whatever you like when you're with Boon Company. I know, sir, but I'm confused. You are hunters, the boldest-looking hunters we've ever seen in Tushim. We know that you've come to slay the Tuskers, maybe get the Devil Pig himself. And we heard you speak of running from them. That said with a note of betrayal in his voice. Shad, did you hear that? Geller asked. Shad grinned. I'm not a post. I heard everything. And with that, he turned to his taller friend and said, Thatch, I'll wager that it's treasure they're after. Why else get away from pigs when you're a hunter? Thatch made no reply to that, so the eager-faced lad turned and looked at Chert, Gord, and finally Geller as he asked, it is a treasure, isn't it? The key you talked about opens a big chest full of silver and gold, doesn't it? The evil place is where some dragon hides its hoard, right? The bard said, stroking his chin. You're as keen-eared as an owl. You mustn't mention any of what you heard ever again. Shad, Thatch, understood? Both lads agreed readily enough, and Thatch added, we'll help you get it, and that way we won't be around others to tell them of the secret. Geller shook his head at that. Oh, my good lads, we could never expose you to the dangers we must face for the journey, let alone the conclusion. A treasure, shall we say. In the morning you must go home. Yes, sir, Thatch said with a downcast expression. Thatch, the smaller lad, cried in disbelief. We can't go back to Tushim without a trophy. And maybe even with one we can't. Lidebow will kill us for sure. Now you shut your chop trap, Shad, or all. Enough of that, my lads, the bard thundered. Thatch had stood up as he spoke and clenched his fists. Shad had been ready to fight, too, when the command came. Both plopped back to the leaf-covered ground, sheepishly looking at their hands. We're friends here, and we don't squabble and fight like a flock of jackdaws. Mind your manners. Now, what's this about someone harming you? Shad means Clydebow, the chief hunter. We borrowed some of his things so we could come with you. Geller looked sternly at the two. Borrowed? Do you mean you stole something belonging to this Clydebow? I guess you'd say that, sir, but we'll bring everything back, won't we, Thatch? Said the small lad in a pleading voice. Thatch decided to make a clean breast of it. We knew that you'd kill many boars, even the one that's a devil. We'll never get to be hunters unless someone like you will let us learn. Else I have to be a thatcher just like my name, and Shad there'll end up as a tailor. "What did you take?" asked the one-eyed bard gently. "Beer spears, boar spears, some old leggings, a loden cloak, a flatchet, and a rucksack," the tall lad ticked off the list. "We needn't any of his other stuff, for I'd taken a leather poke full of grub, and a big knife from my uncle already," volunteered Shad. At that, Gord had laughed. Shad scowled at his small friend. Before he could say anything about this addition, Shad went on. "Don't be cross, Thatch. I didn't say anything about the stuff you took from your master." "Master, you say? Are you prenticed, boys?" interjected Geller. "Aye, both Shad and I are. He to his kinfolk, though, and I to old Reed." Stealing was bad. Bad enough to get the boys flogged and bound to their victims to work out twice the value of the stolen goods, recovered or no. Stealing things from a master by an apprentice was worse still. If the master chose, he could sell the thief into slavery, in redress for the crime. Worst of all, the theft from Clydebow was of relatively high value, and the goods taken were those of his livelihood. That usually meant hanging. All three of the adventurers looked at the lads in wonderment. What could these boys have been thinking? Break. So, with that small commentary, we know the two boys are from Tushum, that where they just went through. But this business of them being apprenticed and because of their actions being able to be sold into slavery. Well, you know, if you remember back to Sog of Old City, even Gord, living as an orphan beggar in the slum court of the worst of, you know, of Greyhawk City, he was aware of his freedom. And although they could kill him, I don't believe they were able to take away his freedom, although, you know, he was sold into an apprenticeship. So here we have Furiondi, supposedly a good nation, and yet one of the punishments here is being sold into slavery. So that puts a striking note against the society, you know, what they thought. Yeah. And as Chris notes, they could also be hanged. Now, in a sense, the hanging punishment is still recognizing their freedom. The slavery is actually could be considered worse than hanging in a sense. So that these two, that even as far up into the wilderness here, slavery seems to be a very accepted and commonplace thing here, a part of the culture. So I just wonder how many of the good societies in Gygax's mind practice slavery. So that is, especially now, a very controversial topic right there. So I don't know. You know, one of the things is Gygax, in this case, was looking at the past and historical countries of medieval time, and yes, they had this indentured servitude and they had slavery, out and out slavery. So entirely possible for what could be considered a good society. It's very hard with the alignment system, because the alignment system is really based on more modern, 20th century morality, and not the kind of morality that is medievalish. And so I think right here we see that this mixture of medieval and more modern ideas about morality. And I don't know how you can place, these things in the alignment system, which is an abstract, and say, that for this society to be good society, it cannot have this practice going in it. So it is a very, you have to really pick and choose what kind of game you want to play. And I would say, I personally would find it very hypocritical to call, you know, like a society that practices slavery as any kind of good society. It's like the City of Greyhawk seemed a very, from Gord's point of view, it's like, where are the good gods? Where are they demanding various good activities? You know, because they are not, they are a kind of timeless. They exist for centuries, and it really strikes me that you really have to decide if you want to run Furiundi as a good nation. You may want to disregard some of this, some of these things that Gygax is bringing up, where he's trying, I think, to be more true to medieval society than to a fantasy society that is not necessarily at the same point in cultural morality as a non-magic society would be. Because there's a lot of things, they don't have technology, but they have magic. And even if they're not, you know, at the point where they have planes and roads and things, they certainly have the ability to fly, to move faster than a car or train by instantaneous transportation, like we saw coming from the plane of the Cat Lord into Tensor's highest chamber. So, you know, I would think in this case, this little comment about them being enslaved for their actions rather than just punished for them, that really, you know, that really strikes me as something you, it might be a small thing if you're looking at a medieval fantasy, but this is, you know, or historical medieval game. This is a medieval fantasy, so it doesn't necessarily have to follow those same cultural indicators that we had in, we saw in our historical past.
Yeah, I don't think I would allow slavery in good nations in any campaign I would run.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that just does not, you know, it does not ring, it doesn't ring the kind of thing with the alignment system. To, if you're going to have use an alignment system where you have definitive, you know, things for good and evil, then, and especially with deities that are supposedly good, I can't think that you can do some of these immoral. And there's nothing, I just see nothing that about slavery that isn't immoral. Now, I mean, that is from my viewpoint, but I don't think it's ever should be a consideration. I think. Like, if you ran a Roman game set in Rome, Rome was known for being decadent and immoral and a generally maybe neutral evil or lawful evil or, you know, some kind of combination, but definitely not a very good society. And, you know, there might have been things that led or better people within it, but it was definitely a lot of evil that went on in the Roman society. So, historically, I just think you immediately look. And, you know, I think we've all been brought up to be on the side of Spartacus and not on the side of Rome. And those were the great servile wars in Rome when their massive slave populations rebelled. And if Furiundi has a slave population, I don't see it as being any better than ancient Rome.
Right.
So I would disagree with that. I would definitely disagree with that as being. Now, I could see, because of the rough areas, they might have very harsh penalties, including hanging, the way that they would have hanging for horse thieves. They might have a very harsh penalties, but it's the slavery that I found, you know, it, completely immoral, and the hanging of these young boys as immoral, but perhaps a little more understandable for the society that they were in. So, you know, it's, we just touch upon these little things that are just, you know, commonplace to what Gygax is writing, but not, I think, you know, they have to really be looked at. All right, I am going to restart.
From a lore perspective, it might be nice for maybe a low or mid-level party to go adventuring into the Vesvi in hunt of the Devil Pig.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, so if you're up in this area, that sounds like Crockport is very interesting. Stump sounds very interesting, although it is very similar to
Nulb.
It sounds very similar to Nulb. But Stump as a place that's mostly evil sounds very interesting to adventure in. Tushum sounds very interesting. And this business with the Devil Pig and going boar hunting, definitely a mid-level or lower mid-level kind of adventure right there. And so you could transport that out of the area. It doesn't have to be up by Tushum, but definitely if you're in the area, here is a good-sounding adventure stuffed right into this. Right, including helping out these two boys who have fled their apprenticeships, and that the characters have to decide what they're going to do about that.
Yeah, it's neat. I mean, it's not cookie cutter at all.
Oh, I really like this idea. So I think we've got a really good base for a nice mid-level or even lower mid-level adventure going on right here. All right, I'm going to restart on page 240, and it is the fourth paragraph down. That won't matter, you see, Thatch said almost as if he had read the men's minds. The prentice breaking, nor the borrowing of the stuff, that is. You're going to kill wild boars aplenty. The Devil Pig that's got everyone in Tushum scared to go into the woods, too. We'll help. And the whole village will call us heroes. We'll give everything back. And Clydebow will have a trophy from us to boot. Then we can be hunters. No, we can't, encountered Little Shad glumly. Don't you recall what they said? They weren't going to look to pig-sticking. We got in trouble for naught, Thatch. Eller looked grim. Where was this Clydebow the hunter when you made free with his gear, he asked. Out after game, sir, said Thatch weakly. They could sneak back into the village before anyone's up, Gord said. Then after replacing what they stole from Clydebow, they can creep back to their own homes. They'd have to take a few whacks, that's sure. But a few commons or a civil noble even will soothe any feelings of anger. Besides, they can claim we forced them to show us the way through the forest and made them take the food, too. Shirt looked doubtful. That's pretty thin, Gordy said. It's all we've got. No argument there, interjected Geller. But I like it not. The story is likely to be questioned, and these two know about other things, shall we say. We'd never, never betray the truth about you hunting for treasure, not boar, Thatch said earnestly. We can't go back, though, Shad chimed in. Because we saw Clydebow in the afternoon, heading back to Tushum. He's found his spears and equipment missing for certain, and tomorrow he'll be on our trail with a vengeance. That tears it. What on earth are we to do with the two? The bard demanded, his tone halfway between mirth and anger. Why, that's easy, Thatch shot back with a broad, wholesome grin. We'll help you get the treasure, Shad and I. Even with just a little share of it, a small part suited to boys like us, we'll be the wealthiest folk in the whole village. We'll tell them all how we used the spears to help kill the evil dragon that guarded the gold. And Clydebow will hang the pair on his wall in honor. We'll pay 10 times the... Enough, enough, Geller said in exasperation. Bring your gear to the fire and bed down with us. We'll settle the matter in the morning. A good sleep will clear the muzziness of your tangled scheme from my head, and I'll be able to solve the problem then. Standing proudly as men, but still sheepish about their predicament, the two lads hurried off to bring in their weapons, provisions, and bedrolls. "How did you net these two slippery little fish?" Chert asked the one-eyed man. Geller covered himself with his cloak, getting ready for sleep as he replied, "I saw someone outside the firelight, thanks to a peep with my enchanted orb. My music has certain powers, and when I played and sang, I drew them in with a warm feeling of home and good friends. Had they been ogres, I doubt they'd have behaved differently." "Well," Gorda opined, "these lads are not ogres, and we can't leave them to their fate. Would you rather they died with us fighting hardened soldiers and fell spellbinders?" Geller grumped from his bed of leaves. "At least with us they'll have a chance," the barbarian said just before the two boys reappeared, bearing armloads of gear. That ended the conversation for the night. While the others were readying for travel the next morning, Ford took a scrap of paper and wrote out a message. To Clyde Bow the Hunter, it said, "Be made aware that we have need of the service of two boys, Thatch and Shad by name. One of these electrum pieces is to cover what was taken from you, with another just like it for good measure. And there are two more luckies here, one for each of the boys' masters. Give them to their rightful owners. We will return soon to learn if you did." He signed it, "The three who hunt devils." Gord tucked the message and the electrum pieces in a place where it would be evident to a keen-eyed woodsman, and made a small blaze above it just to be sure. Geller gave a small cough, and Gord looked up. Startled, Geller pretended to be relieving himself on the tree, but the bard's expression showed that he had seen the whole thing. Gord gave a small shrug, and Geller returned a disapproving look. "You are determined to bring these boys into grief," he said with resignation. "Then be it on your head, and the curly mop of the hulking friend who supports you in this, not on mine." With that, he mounted and began to ride away. There was a scramble to get the last of the gear onto the horses or slung over youthful backs, and the remaining four hurried off after the bard. Gord and Chert rode, and the two boys trotted happily after the horses. All right, well, we're pretty near the end of the night, so it's page 242. The opposite page has a picture, I assume, of the two boys and of Chert holding his boar spear. If you notice, it has a pointed end, and it has a cross, usually a little wider than that, after the diamond-shaped spearhead. And that was so that if a boar or a wolf, these were called wolf spears as well, that if they, if you were rushed by a boar or a wolf, the cross there after the head of the spear would stop the boar or wolf from coming right up the spear to get at you, because that was a particular problem, that these boars, they would just impale themselves completely on the spear and drive up to try to get at you with their teeth. And a boar's teeth can eat right through bone. So, quite a heavy thing there. All right. So Gord has come up with his solution, and hopefully saved any punishment. And in the picture, I assume that's the two boys up behind, backed up, Chert backed up by Thatch and Shad. All right. It is just about 7. I thought this was a very good night here. I really enjoyed this part of the story, surprisingly so, with the boy's tale. And I thought this was a very enjoyable section. There was a little idea for further adventure, either in the woods or up by Tusham, exactly. some lore about Stump and some ideas of, placing it in a different location from the Anna Meyer map. Now, the Darlene map is no way has any scale that could cover these small thorps and villages and stuff. And neither Tusham or Stump or Fountain Spring appear on the Darlene map. So I think it's up to us to look at all this and decide what to use or not. All right, 7 o'clock. I'm going to call in Craig and kick him out.